I am the chief revenue officer with Salt Lending. Started the first Bitcoin and blockchain course at the University of Colorado. There's a real opportunity, and Bitcoin brings the ability for anyone to put into place the strategies and tactics of the ultra wealthy. And that is going to be a real game changer. One of the sort of philosophies we have at Salt Lending is it's your Bitcoin and we want it to stay your Bitcoin. Credit score doesn't come into play. They're trying to evaluate you in terms of what is your ability to repay? What's your ability to afford this? And how much can I trust you, right? So with Bitcoin, we sort of remove that element. Hey, you've got the asset. I now can choose to borrow against it, but it's on my terms.
Finding out that there's an option that is better for you. It's like health for your wealth. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So today I have Hunter Albright with me. I want to hear what you're doing in the Bitcoin space. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Happy to. And Stacey, it's a pleasure to be here today. I am the chief revenue officer with Salt Lending. I got started in sort of my Bitcoin journey about 2017. After having spent sort of several decades in traditional finance, really focusing on consumer payments and consumer lending. And since then, I started off really around education. I started the first Bitcoin and blockchain course at the University of Colorado, where I'm an adjunct faculty member teaching strategy and entrepreneurship, and really have been sort of going in deeper ever since. And joined Salt Lending about 2.5 years ago because I sort of, you know, realized that Bitcoin as an asset class, has a lot of potential for a lot of the things that I think the community knows about in terms of really sort of self-sovereignty and thinking about sort of financial freedom and flexibility, but also the ability to build wealth. I think that there's a real opportunity in Bitcoin as a technology brings the ability for anyone to really start to practice and put into place the strategies and tactics of the ultra wealthy in terms of building wealth. And I think that is going to be a sort of real game changer in terms of how anybody thinks about their own finances and their own wealth.
I love that. I love that you saw that and you realized that this is the way to go in the future. And what inspired you to first bring blockchain education to CU Boulder?
So I was, you know, as I mentioned, I had spent, you know, ran global credit card and payment card portfolios for leading banks and really understood both the strengths and the weaknesses of the current system. And as I started to understand and go deeper into the actual technology of Bitcoin and blockchain, felt like it was just really solving a problem in terms of the transparency, in terms of the peer-to-peer sort of direct nature of transactions, as well as really sort of the divisibility of the asset type. And, you know, I have a background, I've got a PhD in systems engineering and really focused on AI in my research, which got me into financial services. And so really look at that aspect and being important in terms of the opportunity for Bitcoin and sort of digital assets to play an increasing role, not only in terms of how we think about wealth, how we think about payments, but also how we and machines will do transactions and protect data going forward, with which I think with the growth of AI and what we've seen over the past 2.5 to 3 years is becoming increasingly more important about how we think about protecting our own data, as well as ensuring we get compensated when and if it's used.
Yes, I agree with that. It seems like Bitcoin is the currency of, you know, technology and AI, and it's the world is shifting that way. I love that you're a systems engineer because I always feel that people with that background understand this system. They understand Bitcoin and they're able to just see the way that it is interacting with the rest of the world. And so when you teach, are there a lot of courses being taught like this, what you're teaching at Boulder?
There is more coming along. I think early on, it was really driven by the interest of sort of student clubs at a lot of universities. There, you know, in sort of, I would say, 2015, 2016, as there was a ramp up in interest in sort of the price, there's been a lot of student clubs that formed really more from a trading and from an investment perspective. And so About that same time, I got involved in a nonprofit called C4, which is really doing a lot around Bitcoin sort of education. They run sort of, I'm on the advisory committee there, and we sort of help build out the certified Bitcoin professional as an exam to help people really learn the basics about what is Bitcoin, what's behind the technology, how can they use it? And as that started to build and more people sort of started to show interest, both in terms of it as a digital asset, but also wanting to know more about the technology, the philosophy, and a lot of the underpinnings, it has become clear that it needs to be taught more as a course so people can start to piece those things together. And I do, it is spreading more globally around sort of what is available both at universities, but also more and more education is available just through YouTube and other places, which is great because I think how people are getting educated is changing. And it needs to be more accessible, and there needs to be more tools out there for people to understand how to, one, get started and then evolve how they're using it in their lives.
Yeah, it's very important to be teaching it in schools because it is being taught worldwide and there is so much education available online and on YouTube. So why wouldn't it be mandatory that it's taught in colleges when it's such a revolutionary technology that people should understand, especially at a university level? Do you think it should be part of a general education course for people? I mean, do you think it's that important where everybody should learn about it?
I do. I mean, I think it's really interesting. I mean, I'm of a generation where I've always been tech forward and emerging tech forward with a lot of what I've done. But, you know, when I look at sort of the students that have gone through my classes and a lot of the people that I interact with, I mean, everybody thinks about currency, about money, you know, as being digital first. And that's a real shift. And so when people think about financial systems, they think about sort of investing and wealth. There's just a real bent towards, you know, sort of a digital first mentality. And so I think Bitcoin, I think sort of blockchain, I think people need to understand the potential of the technologies, where they can be applied, as well as some of the pitfalls, so that they can understand how to, you know, interact in the community and interact in sort of the ecosystems where it's used. I do think we are going to have a split system between sort of digital currencies and sort of traditional finance for easily 10 plus years, just because there's a bunch of wealth with people that may be more inclined to get into Bitcoin from an investment point of view, but less inclined to adopt it from a full, hey, I'm going all in terms of trying to live the Bitcoin standard and use it for everything that I'm sort of both investing in as well as use it for a means of exchange or a means of purchase.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, when you said that Bitcoin is, you know, finance is going digital, it's interesting because finance has been going digital since, you know, debt and credit cards have become, you know, pretty much the norm. So people don't think about cash anymore or using cash. It's like people get direct deposit. Everything is digital already. But when you learn about Bitcoin, it's important because you're learning about what money truly is, you know, and how money can be sound again and how, like, it's just you're actually learning about money because people don't really understand inflation and what money really is and how the biggest part for me is it's your time spent working. So it's like your energy is spent using that time in exchange for something. And that something that you're getting is being devalued every year, you know? So it's important to learn the difference between credit and money. And Bitcoin is backed by something that can't be inflated away. And that's just, I think, agreeing with you that it should be a more mainstream. And I'm happy that you're teaching people about it and you're actually doing this because I didn't think it was really being taught in university. So it's nice to see that people like you are doing this and actually educating students.
Yeah, there's definitely an increasing emphasis on trying to teach, I think more broadly across sort of the universities, teach Bitcoin, teach blockchain sort of as an emerging tech and to help people understand it. I think it's probably being taught less really in terms of the financial aspect, in terms of its more broader or say sort of macro impact on the economy and sort of both within a nation as well as globally. And I also feel like it's important for people to start to understand, you know, that Bitcoin really represents, you know, a different opportunity to think about whether it's a corporate wealth on the treasury or even individual wealth. It's teaching financial literacy skills that are really missing more broadly. When I came up and was doing work in sort of retail banking and sort of payment cards, so much of that emphasis was on what I refer to as, you know, it is unsecured lending. And that is people learning to use debt almost as an advance against sort of future earnings about future income. And especially I would say in the United States where I am, is it taught us a lot of bad habits, right? We were a lot of unsecured credit is used to buy discretionary items. It's trying to sort of live a life that maybe you're not there yet and want you aspire to. Whereas I think what people are showing with Bitcoin, especially in terms of, you know, secured, you know, sort of Bitcoin-backed loans and really thinking about building your wealth with that asset class, is much more akin to securitized lending, where, you know, as I mentioned earlier, what the wealth have done traditionally is with their stock portfolios or their real estate portfolios really allowed them to access the value that's being created in those assets that they are converting labor-based income into sort of appreciating and wealth-generating assets. And I think that's going to be a really important skill for people to learn, to take control of their own finances, to take control of their own wealth, and understand those skills that they need to be able to more effectively manage it today and in the future.
Yeah. It definitely is something that can help you build that so that you can have something in the future to manage instead of just, letting it slowly melt away. So how did you get involved with SALT Lending?
So I'm in Colorado, and as I was spending more time in sort of the Bitcoin and sort of the digital asset space, got introduced to the founders and a number of employees that were at SALT Lending. Really sort of connected, having had a background in consumer lending and consumer payments, understood what the opportunity was, what the need was, and philosophically it aligned with what I thought was really needed to help both companies that have Bitcoin on the treasury, as well as individuals that want to use Bitcoin to sort of build their wealth and really manage their finances as they want. I have looked at a lot of my students that have gone through the classes and talked to them about the challenge of getting on the housing ladder in terms of building up enough sort of wealth to be able to get into some of the more traditional investment vehicles that would teach them some of the skills about borrowing against your assets, not having to sell. But I think Bitcoin offers that opportunity for anybody at a much smaller price point and a much easier entry point in terms of getting involved and how to think about learning about your finances, learning about how to build your wealth, learning about the impact of inflation and how you want to make sure you have hedges against it, or you have vehicles to protect yourself from inflation, and then be able to think about, okay, now what do I want to do in terms of my strategy for building wealth as I think about interacting both in terms of traditional finance as well as in the Bitcoin economy.
I love that. And how do you feel like about the whole, you know, getting loans on your Bitcoin? I love the idea of not having to sell your Bitcoin if you need to use Bitcoin for something in life, but you know that you don't want to, you know, sell it. But I think in my eye or view, you know, Bitcoin teaches you responsible behavior when it comes to finance. So I think that sometimes in the traditional finance space, people, like you said earlier, like have irresponsible lending habits or borrowing habits. And I think that with Bitcoin, people understand that if you are going to take a Bitcoin loan, you better do it in a responsible way, because you understand the value that Bitcoin could increase over time. So you don't want to do it irresponsibly. You don't want to borrow more than you can afford to pay back. And so I think, do you teach that to people when you do give them a loan? Is it something that you try to not make sure people are over leveraged so that they don't get in trouble financially that way and regret doing that loan?
No, I think it's really important. And then, you know, I think it's important, you know, one of the sort of philosophies we have at SALT Lending is like, it's your Bitcoin and we want it to stay your Bitcoin. There are companies out there that have models that are really, I think lending models where there is a quasi acquisition strategy in terms of liquidation and hitting some of the margin calls. And I would completely agree with you. I think people really need to understand lending. I think lending has a role to play and would definitely be educating people on, you know, only be borrowing against a portion of your portfolio that you have. And when you borrow against it, really understand one of the key levers is sort of your loan to value ratio. So as an example, if we say a Bitcoin's worth $100,000, you know, if you borrow $30,000 against it, then that would be a 30% LTV, loan to value ratio. And historically, that has been very safe in terms of being able to absorb any amount of price drop, significant price drops without sort of the need to be urgently meeting margin calls or having a really heightened fear of liquidation. And I think that's a really good place for people to start to become more comfortable with being able to leverage their asset. Now, there's a lot of great reasons to be doing that, right? You can take money out without any tax implications. A lot of our customers are leveraging loans really for three primary use cases. The first one is they are using it for purchases that are important to them. They have an asset, they have developed wealth or value that they want to tap into. And it might be because they want to buy a car. It might be because they want to take a trip or they want to make sort of, you know, they put a down payment on a home. There's a variety of use cases where it really can enable people, right, as an alternative to savings to build that value. And then when you want to use it, tap into it. The second primary use case is we have a lot of people that are leveraging their Bitcoin value, their Bitcoin wealth to either retire off of or just even supplement their income. So they're looking at it from a, hey, I don't want to be as tax efficient or avoid taxes as much as possible. And I want to sort of borrow against it to sort of just allow me to live my life. And then the third strategy and use case that people have is they're doing it for investment. And it might be buying more Bitcoin or it might be buying real estate or other assets that might be income generating. So you can get that income because of how you're putting your dollars to work now in multiple ways to be able to balance out your overall portfolio. And I think this is one of the things that I'm really excited about Bitcoin in general is that it encourages people to explore a whole set of financial tools and strategies and tactics that generally have not been open to a lot of people. And I think hopefully as a generation, it will encourage people to be more financially independent. It will encourage people to be more financially savvy and ultimately more financially secure as they start to understand how to leverage Bitcoin as an asset class with the other investments and other financial.
Sorry, I think we froze a little bit. Sometimes the computers get glitchy and they freeze, no problem at all. So I wanted to continue on what you were talking about. I wanted to ask you about what your thoughts were about the recent news of Bitcoin being used as collateral for mortgage loans.
Yep. I think that's exciting news in terms of the U.S. starting to recognize the value of the asset class. I think it will give Bitcoin owners a lot more flexibility and credit for the wealth that they have been able to create and accumulate by being able to use it within sort of to take out a mortgage. I mean, that historically, I mean, that's been one of the primary use cases for a lot of our customers is borrowing against their Bitcoin to buy a home, whether it's either to put down a down payment and or to be able to, you know, purchase the home outright with the value. Now, being able to show it and then be able to sort of get a traditional mortgage, I think really will allow people to take advantage of more of the traditional financial tools that will work really well in combination with their Bitcoin portfolio.
That's great. A lot of people argue that, you know, what can you do with Bitcoin? It just sits there and you save it. But it is being used as a form of payment all over the world. But now seeing that it's being recognized as this collateral, it's also, you know, you could use it to get a loan, you know, to get something that you need in life.
Yeah. Well, and get recognized for it, right? Yeah. I mean, it is, especially if you are a global citizen and you're trying to travel. I mean, I moved overseas and getting a new, even unsecured line of credit when you move into a new country is really hard, right? You have no credit history, you have no credit score. And so now with the opportunity to be able to have an asset, to be able to have wealth that you can demonstrate you own, really opens up a lot more flexibility. I mean, that's one of the things we get a lot of people coming to SALT Lending to be able to access cash because They don't want to use sort of a traditional credit system where credit score is required, but they still need cash to operate within whatever ecosystem they are in, whatever country they are in, whether it's sort of making payments or even just have interacting from a commerce perspective. And so having that flexibility, and I think ultimately allowing people to make that their own choice about what they want to do is great.
Yeah. And being able to get that loan, like you said, if you are moving countries and you have all your assets in some sort of a traditional stock market, or if you only have credit score in one country and not another, that's true. That makes so much sense that, you know, having Bitcoin is global. You know, you can go anywhere and get a loan anywhere that you decide to live, and you're not tied to the country you grew up in. So also, I wanted to ask you about, like, so you said about credit score. So with Bitcoin loans, getting a loan on your asset, does credit score come into play when you decide an interest rate for people, or is that more of a, you know, new way of thinking?
No, we don't use, and I don't think a lot of the Bitcoin-backed lenders use credit score. I mean, so it really is for people that have wanting to operate outside that system or just not require it. We do work closely with regulators, and so we go through an ID and sort of verification stage. And then once collateral has been deposited, we do anti-money laundering checks in order, you know, in the process of our underwriting for a new loan. But credit score doesn't come into play, is not used in that process.
I love that.
It's really on the back of the collateral and the assets that you deposit on the platform.
Yeah, I love that, because it shouldn't be tied to a credit score, because your credit score is tied to a fiat debt-based system. So people's credit score comes into play when they've been living in that world. They've been using that sort of a platform, you know, so that's where your credit score matters in debt, you know, in the debt world. But when you're moving to, you know, your assets to a Bitcoin world, which is sound money, it's real money. It's not a debt-based system, you know, so it shouldn't be tied to a credit score that's on a different system.
Yeah, and it's a really of a change of mindset, right? It's going from unsecured lending, where somebody is giving you money in advance of, or in lieu of you actually having the asset. And so they're trying to evaluate you in terms of what is your ability to repay? What's your ability to afford this? And how much can I trust you, right? So with Bitcoin, we sort of remove that element. Hey, you've got the asset. You can show that you have the asset. And now as a owner of Bitcoin, as a sort of, you know, that having that wealth, I now can choose to borrow against it, but it's on my terms.
True.
Right? I can, how much do I want to leverage? How do I want to use that cash? And going from unsecured lending to secured lending, I think, is one of the key financial tools that we need to be educating more people about. I think it also is really good for the larger sort of economy. So one of the things that I would say in like the 80s and the 90s and sort of the 2000s, unsecured lending really is another way to print money. Unsecured lending is sort of an influx of money into an ecosystem that helps drive up inflation. It increases the money supply. And so as a culture and as larger groups of people move to more secured back borrowing, that is, I think, a much safer and sounder approach to managing sort of a macroeconomic view and financial systems, right? Because the value is already there. We're borrowing against wealth that we've already created. I think it also encourages better investing and savings habits, which historically has really been lacking in terms of people's discipline and both awareness of what to do.
True. Yeah, I love that explanation for people, because it's like somebody who, when it comes to assets, it's like somebody who already has their house paid off and they take out a loan on that house, you know, so you already show that you've paid it off and you're getting a secured loan. And then the unsecured loans is the promise, you know, the promise of how much do we trust you that we can give you money that you didn't yet make, you know? So it's literally like you're getting a loan for something that does contribute to inflation, because that money is not just sitting there, you know, there's so much debt in the system. They don't have all this extra cash. They're just creating a number in a ledger and giving it to you, hoping that you'll eventually pay it back. So it's a level of trust that's where your credit score comes into play. So this is definitely the secured back lending. I love it's showing that you already are responsible because you already have this thing that you can use to leverage. So I love that. What do you think about, what are your thoughts on companies like Bitcoin treasury companies?
So I think it's a great, it will be a great enabler, I think, for company stability and resiliency going forward. So there's obviously some companies that are using, they're using debt, they're sort of buying Bitcoin with sort of their revenues and really trying to build up the value of the business that way. I think I've done a lot of work in Colorado and other places with rural entrepreneurs and small and medium-sized business entrepreneurs. I think there's a huge opportunity for those businesses to be thinking strategically about how to take 5-10% of their revenues and start be buying Bitcoin so that they can build up this asset on their treasury that will help them, you know, endure any of the ups and downs of basically being an entrepreneur and being a small business owner and not have to go rely on a regional or local bank to find that loan and get approved for that loan. And I think, you know, given what we're seeing with the economy and seeing more people probably going to need to be entrepreneurs, going to need to have their own business in one shape, form or another, just because of the direction the overall sort of economy is going, that this will be a real enabler. Like if you can accumulate that asset that you can then borrow against to either invest in your business or bridge sort of more harder times, then it will be hopefully a real enabler to help businesses be more successful and sort of succeed over longer periods of time.
Yeah, it's a great way for young people to build wealth too, because if you want to try to get an asset to leverage against if you need money in the future, many young people can't afford to buy a home right now. So you can't buy a full home if you're young, but you can buy pieces of a Bitcoin to grow your wealth over time and then eventually use portions of that to do something in your life that you need to do. So it's much easier for somebody who's for any age, you know, for whatever reason you need to grow your business or to leverage the asset to even buy more Bitcoin, like you said, but in a responsible way, I would say yes. But the thing is, yeah, for young people, it's very important because you can't build an asset in pieces. Usually you can't get something like a huge chunk of something, you know, that's real, that's tangible. So even though people sometimes argue that Bitcoin is intangible, it's the most real thing we have as far as truth and protection from inflation and theft.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's either usually homes or Bitcoin, I feel.
And I would add to that for a lot of entrepreneurs, right? People start businesses because they want to build up equity in something that has this ability to have a greater appreciation or a faster sort of growth in terms of overall value. But traditionally, it's been really hard to tap into that equity, the value of that equity.
Right.
Because you either have to sell it or you would then have to maybe go to a bank or that you could get a loan against sort of your business.
Right.
Whereas if you're methodical and you sort of think about how you want to acquire Bitcoin and have it on your treasury, as you basically build up the value in your business, you could start to borrow against it without the need to sell any of your ownership. So you maintain more control, you maintain more equity in your business, and you can tap into its value more efficiently than a lot of the traditional methods. And again, I think that's going to be, because one of the hardest things for a small business is both cash flow and then two, being able to find loans to bridge the cash flow needs that they might have, whether it's inventory, whether it's hiring, or just sort of a harder down, you know, sort of a period of down sales. I think that will become really important to being able to tap into that. But equally on the upside, hey, you've built up a lot of value. You don't necessarily want to take any cash out of the company per se in terms of selling it. Then you just borrow against some of the assets that are in it. It gives you a lot of flexibility as an owner to how to manage that asset based on where you are in your life and what your goals are.
It puts you more in control. It's a really refreshing way and, you know, very future thinking way to evolve this entire system. So I love that. So let me see. I wanted to ask you about, what do you think about all of the fear? Because I think so many people that hear about crypto or blockchain, they don't really understand that Bitcoin is separate. And how did FTX affect SALT lending, or how do you look at what FTX caused as far as the view of people thinking about Bitcoin in a certain way? Do you think that there's an impact in, or do you think it helped seeing that that happened and then showing that it's different with SALT lending?
Yeah, I look, I think, you know, the ecosystem still has a way to go in terms of educating people on the asset class around Bitcoin. I think that, you know, in terms of Celsius, BlockFi, FTX, you know, there's still a lot of there is still a perception that there's fraud out there, that, you know, we are all sort of, you know, doing bad things with Bitcoin, and the digital currency in general has, you know, there's sort of shady things going on. And I think all of us still need to sort of communicate that that's not happening. That's not true. There's a lot of greater trust coming into the ecosystem because of more of the larger players that are coming in, the increase of capital that's coming in.
Right.
But I do think that anywhere going from sort of meme coins to sort of fraud and other sort of NFTs is hard, because it muddies the water with people that are not necessarily trying to ensure that the assets are as pristine or as hard money as Bitcoin. And, you know, just requires more education to sort of get over that and help people understand about sort of all of the spectrum of digital assets that are out there, and what's more valuable and what's less valuable. And in many respects, it's no different than stocks, right? There's penny stocks, and then there's stocks that sort of people put more trust into. But even that is still very different than Bitcoin, right? In terms of sort of, you can have sort of a stock that is really valued and really sort of sought after and trusted in terms of the management of the company, but there's still a lot of things that could go wrong.
Right.
And I still think that's a safer bet, but still a very different bet than investing in Bitcoin and thinking about what that opportunity is, to how to be able to leverage that asset over a longer period of time.
Yeah. And Bitcoin is a, like you said, a pristine asset, because even if you get stock in a really respectable company that you don't know really what could happen in the future, this company could still issue more stock, and, you know, the supply could still be increased. More Bitcoin is set. It'll never change. So when it comes to these loans in the future, like NFTs or other crypto, there will probably be companies issuing, you know, lending on those assets. But like you said too, it's if you're going to put money in a penny stock, you could lose it all. So if people do decide to get something other than the pristine asset Bitcoin and get something else to leverage against, you could lose it, you know. So it's like, you really, it's a gamble, you know. It's the crypto casino, as they call it. But yeah, Bitcoin is different than those. It's different than stocks. It really is a pristine asset. And it's amazing that more of the world is seeing that, you know, and it's because it's been so trusted, because it's never been hacked. It's never gone down. It's never had a problem, even through all the attacks it's had over the years. It's showing its strength through time. So it's trustworthy that way. And it's really nice. It's nice that we have something like that.
Well, and I think that's a big point to make, right? People are investing. You know, I get the question a lot, is like, why does Bitcoin have its value? What's sort of driving it? And you know, one answer is like proof of work. People paid for the energy. They put in the time to sort of mine the Bitcoin. So there's value in terms of what was invested to get sort of the original mining. And I also then think that people are basically paying for the security. That when you look at, to your point, that the Bitcoin network, the Bitcoin sort of blockchain, has never been compromised. It is sort of the most resilient and secure piece of technology that we basically have globally now. Yes, there have been fraudulent activities. Companies have been hacked. Individuals have given up seed phrases and other things that have compromised their own assets. But as an overall sort of Bitcoin blockchain, the security has not been sort of compromised. And so people are investing in that security.
Yeah.
I think that I am curious to see how, as the security of the network continues to be proven and the value goes up, whether we start to see a change in terms of use of Bitcoin for payments. I think that it will discourage people from selling, especially as more companies come into the lending space, more companies come into the ecosystem to be able to provide utility for people that own Bitcoin. I think people will start to see it as an asset to hodl, to hold on to for a longer period of time. And you'll just make trade-offs. Like, I don't think there's one right answer for all payments. I think we'll see more currencies have very use-specific application. And it might be that Bitcoin becomes, hey, if you're only going to make super large payments, that's where it's efficient from a cost perspective and you're willing to do it. And then otherwise, you find other means and mechanisms to either borrow against your Bitcoin or sort of leverage other assets for, you're getting almost like sort of petty cash type payments in terms of just going ahead to live your life.
Yeah, I think that I love that Bitcoin is that impenetrable shield. You know, that's the way that I love to think about it when people ask me what backs Bitcoin. Well, it's backed by the fact that the network is so global and massive and warehouses full of supercomputers that are confirming the transactions that haven't been penetrated. It's a defense, it's a shield, a digital shield against anybody manipulating that. So it can't be inflated. So I love that the most about Bitcoin. That's what backs Bitcoin is the big shield that's around it. So that's like a very important, you know, to remind people that when they ask what backs it, because it's just so hard to understand. And it is confused with all these other, you know, ways that either exchanges were fraudulent or people, you know, gave up their seed phrase or whatever might have happened. But it was never the network. It never went down. So I think that that's a very interesting point. And what I did want to ask your thoughts about also is when we talk about the Bitcoin treasury companies, what are your ideas? Because it seems so hard for me to understand with the amount of Bitcoin that's available on exchanges. It's very little. I think it's under 2 million coins left on exchanges, if I'm right. And with the amount of buying pressure that's happening between institutions and, you know, governments, some of these institutions like MicroStrategy alone is accumulating, I think, as much Bitcoin as is released by miners per day. And then that's just MicroStrategy. So what I don't understand is the whole idea of the paper Bitcoin. People are saying that a lot. People are saying that for the amount of buying pressure that there is, why is the price so level and not really just increasing dramatically? Do you have any thoughts on that? Because that's very hard for me to comprehend.
No, I mean, I don't. I mean, I think as more companies come in, I mean, the one thing that's great about Bitcoin, right, it's a 24/7 market. You have a lot of visibility in terms of if you're so inclined to learn more about the futures markets, to sort of see where people are making bets on being long on Bitcoin or even being short on Bitcoin. It also helps illustrate provides a lot of data in terms of the demand. And so I think that's very favorable for really anybody that has the inclination to sort of start to learn about it. But as more people come into it, I would expect the price to go up just because of increased scarcity, that if people are not willing to sell it, then the price, you know, will need to go up in order to be able to get somebody to part, you know, be willing to sort of sell some of it.
Right.
And I think that's behind a lot of the very bullish price predictions, is that there's going to be countries, there's going to be companies, there's going to be larger groups that basically have a mandate to go buy Bitcoin. You know, it will drive, it would seem from sort of a macroeconomic perspective, drive up the price just because there's, you know, there's less available, there's less that's being mined, and more people are wanting to hold on to it as opposed to sell it.
Yeah.
Now, I think as more traditional finance companies start to own Bitcoin, it will be interesting to see how they manage it in terms of taking gains, as well as sort of then just buying sell of it as part of the overall risk strategy or sort of revenue, sort of financial management of the bank. Because Bitcoin is a very different asset than a lot of those financial institutions are used to managing. So it'll be interesting to see how they incorporate it in with their existing risk management processes and protocols to understand how to get the most out of it.
You got me thinking. I have a crazy thought, you know, but it's something that I think is, you know, the way my mind works a little bit. But so futures markets, you mentioned that, and that I think is a really good point. When you think about why Bitcoin's price has been so level when it comes to these treasury companies, it doesn't technically mean paper Bitcoin that they're buying, but I think that there's so much pressure with so much big money in the world that is betting, you know, 10x, whatever, they're betting, you know, leverage trading Bitcoin with huge amounts of money. So I think the futures market is really what's keeping the price so level because there's so much betting going back and forth. So what makes me think about that is, you know, when you think about The Big Short and you think about what happened in 2008, and you think about the mortgage, you know, bubble that was happening with the secured backed mortgages. And then now we think of this whole system being this debt bubble that we're, you know, our national debt is so high, our interest payments on that national debt are astronomical. And it's hard to keep up with because of the, you know, the printing that has to continue in order to keep solvent and keep, you know, staying afloat. But what makes me think what would happen when people talk about this Bitcoin Godzilla candle, how it could just like take off and just over, it could be like overnight, almost like it could be $1 million or something. What makes me think that could happen, like how that could happen, is I feel like the, and this is just, again, my crazy thoughts, it's not like this would happen, but when you think about the dollar in the fourth turning and how all these things, you know, the dollar has lasted for so long, but it's coming to an end and we're shifting into this future a currency where Bitcoin will be kind of like a standard across the world. When that ship sinks, you know, when that debt bubble pops, it makes me think that these future markets might go down with it. And that's when we'll see that Godzilla candle. So I think like as long as this future market exists and this dollar betting or fiat betting trading system is pumping hard, you know, I think that that's what's kind of hindering, you know, that Godzilla candle from popping off. So I just kind of like, I don't know if it's that nobody wants to see the dollar just collapse, you know, that would be chaos, you know? So I think they're going to try to keep that train going as much as possible, but I think it's inevitable, you know, and I think the futures markets will go with it.
Yeah. I mean, I am not a trader by training or even by sort of practice. And so I'm aware of the futures markets and I think there's some interesting data. I'm definitely not an expert to be sort of advising on it, but I do think it's a great set of information for everybody to be aware of that's out there. And I think it's very beneficial that it's out there 24/7, right? In terms of really providing access. I do agree with you, right? A lot of the bets that's being made, either in terms of being long Bitcoin or being short Bitcoin, but basically not requiring people to buy spot Bitcoin, so actually acquire the asset, has an influence on the overall market. How that plays out, I don't really know. But I do think, to your point, we're seeing more people increasing their interest and their curiosity as Bitcoin, as a hedge against the dollar, as a hedge against inflation. I do think it's going to be really interesting to watch what happens with stablecoin, because I think part of the strategy with more US dollar denominated stablecoin and the encouragement of that is to help sort of stabilize that as a reserve currency, even in cooperation with an asset like Bitcoin. And that will find, you know, the global economy will find a way to sort of balance out both these sort of interest rates. Essentially, you know, we're looking at now exchange rates between fiat currencies and digital assets, fiat currencies and Bitcoin. And there's more to be learned there. There's some more for the global economy to understand how to utilize and price that appropriately. And people, you know, to a certain extent, I think, you know, Michael Saylor has sort of been famously quoted that right now the volatility is an asset of the network, both allowing people to participate, make revenue, and also generate additional interest in it. If we take away all the volatility, then there'll be a lot of players that will lose interest in Bitcoin. But also, it works well for a lot of the people that want to stay in it long term, and they choose to buy on the dips, right? They choose to like, hey, I'm getting Bitcoin at a discount. I'm going to take advantage of it because I look at Bitcoin as a long-term asset. And so I think as we see, you know, people's, you know, going back to a little bit of our earlier point, as we see the financial literacy of a generation improve, I think we'll see some of the dynamics and the trends within sort of the economic system start to change.
Yeah. The whole point about you saying like what Michael Saylor said, volatility is vitality. You know, I agree with that because yes, it as Bitcoin dips, more and more people get interested, and then as it rises, more people get interested. But do you think that the 30% drawdown days are behind us? Because lately, like we see these, you know, even if it's a $10,000 daily candle going up or down, it's still not that high of a percentage compared to like being in Bitcoin earlier, where you would see 30-40% drops in price pretty fast, you know, within days, you know, at a time. And it was such a roller coaster ride emotionally for people who were involved in Bitcoin during that time. And that's what really built our strength and conviction, because going through that was very hard, but it also made you realize, okay, great, I can collect more of this thing during those dips. Those were actual dips, you know? Yeah. I don't think these really now are considered dips, because I think for most people like me that are buying Bitcoin, dollar cost averaging at this point. So even if somebody were to buy $1,000 in Bitcoin, whether it's $100,000 or $110,000, it's really what, like a 40% difference or $40 difference, you know? So it's like, I don't know, it's not that big of a, it doesn't matter if you buy it $10,000 up or down, if you're not spending billions, you know, to buy, or millions to buy Bitcoin. But I just think that those huge days of drawdowns are maybe behind us with all this adoption that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any of us know what's going to happen in the future. And I would hope that that is the case. I think the data does show that the volatility is tightening up. It's still there, but decreasing compared to sort of the early years of sort of Bitcoin. But I still think until we see multiple years where there is sort of no more than a 10 or a 20% drop, right, the part, you know, would encourage people to plan for the possibility, going back to like if you're borrowing against it or if you're leveraging it in other ways, to be really sensible about it. But yeah, hopefully it is there. But at the same time, we still need more, because people are holding on to it. It still doesn't take that much to move the market, which can help drive some of those drops, as well as drive some of the increases. And so there's a little bit of like, you know, what are we really hoping for in terms of the market? Because as an asset that, you know, I think we all believe has great opportunity in its appreciation over the longer period of time, that also decreases the volume that's being exchanged on a daily basis, which, you know, potentially invites bigger swings when there is a bigger player that needs to come in and either sell or buy. I think it's one of the things that the Bitcoin network really needs to continue to encourage and will benefit by having sort of more distribution of who owns the assets, more distribution of smaller miners on the network. All of that will help improve the stability, not only continued stability in the security, but stability in the price, as there's more people that are looking to trade, buy and sell Bitcoin on a daily basis.
Right. I like that you said that too, because it's like, if you, as a lender, as a Bitcoin lender, to say, yeah, I don't see it going down more than 5% a day forever. You know, it's like, that's not, even though that's my kind of way of thinking about it, at least I'm not the one lending or like giving people money against their Bitcoin thinking the way I think, because it's a responsible way to think, to be a little bit paranoid, even though you believe that Bitcoin will go up a lot in the future. You have to prepare for that downside. And also, it'd be nice to have more dry powder, as they say, when that does happen, if it does happen. But it's a good way to think about it, especially when you're a lender, because you have to prepare for big swings so that you're not over leveraged and you don't lose your Bitcoin. So I love that your company thinks of it that way. They want you to preserve it. They don't, you know, you don't want to see people lose it. So you wouldn't want to advise people that it's the days of those swings are completely behind us, unless you see multiple years. You know, the more time that passes, the more sure you could be that you can alter your stance on that. But yeah, if it's greater than 4 years at a time, because people see the 4 year cycles with the Bitcoin halvings, and they kind of, you know, look at it at least in that view, as at the very least. So
yeah. And we'll see whether we break that cycle, you know, coming up as we go through the next several years and really, you know, buck that trend. And then sort of, you know, what it will look like for everybody was really unknown at this point.
Because I think that's the whole debate, is are the 4 year cycles gone? Are they not? So I guess the cycle will kind of tell us. And then it's still, even if it does break a trend this cycle, it doesn't mean that it'll continue forever, you know. So it's like, you still, I think as time passes, people will notice new trends in bigger periods of time, you know. So that's why it's always fun to kind of, you know, even though I'm not a trader, I don't trade Bitcoin, I used to start off with looking at charts and trying to think I was a crypto trader before I understood Bitcoin. But for me, it's still fun to see, like when I look at a Bitcoin chart, it reminds me of what the mentality is of people at that time, just seeing the volume. And, you know, I like to predict in my mind, like, does that mean that, you know, the price will be going down or up based on how much volume. So I like to play that game and look at charts on a bigger or smaller view just to kind of see what Bitcoin was doing. It's nice to see its journey and to see kind of the trends at different periods of time. So it's a fun thing to still watch, and I enjoy it as a hobby, but definitely not a trader.
Well, and I think it's one of the things that makes, for me, makes Bitcoin so interesting, right? It's this one piece of technology that not only is it a technology that basically in math we trust, right, in terms of how it's been designed from a systems perspective, but you get exposure to so many wonderful things that you might not otherwise think about, right? It introduces or maybe exposes people to think about trading. It exposes people to think about sort of monetary policy and macroeconomic trends, as well as just sort of money philosophy and other philosophical sort of points that come along with the community, especially in terms of what was the prompt for why Bitcoin got started. So, you know, it just, I feel like it's this wealth of topics and themes and really interesting people to talk with that come at it from so many different perspectives that I think, for me, it makes it super interesting to engage with the community and help out where I can.
Yeah, I love that too. It's nice to be able to hear, because there's such a range of perspectives and a range of different people that found Bitcoin for all different reasons. Yeah, just going from the origin story to figuring out why Satoshi did what he did, he or she or they, why they decided to start this at the time that they decided to start it, to speculate on, you know, just what kind of person he was, you know, just all the, it's like a cool story to kind of think of in your mind. And all these people just are fascinated by the origin story of it. And yeah, philosophically, spiritually, there's so many different perspectives on it. And it's because it just kind of breaks all these ideals about what you thought the world was really like. So it's, I love talking to more people about it and hearing their journey and hearing how they got into it and what everyone can contribute, like you are, how you're able to contribute to teaching people about it. Is really, really great to hear, because I didn't know that was happening. And I'm very excited to hear about that, because I hear so many students that are in, you know, I'm a hairdresser, you know, but there's a lot of college students that come in to the salon. And when they talk about being in finance, I haven't heard any yet talk about, you know, blockchain or Bitcoin being one of their courses. And I do talk about my podcast a lot at work. So I hope to hear that more from students, that they're learning about this stuff, even if they're not in finance and they're just learning in college and just figure, you know, I think it should be more mainstream education.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a lot more education and I think that's needed globally, and for people to understand what might also be career paths for them, as well as how they can better manage their own financial situation. I think that in particular, globally, more people need to be taught about finance earlier and sort of financial management, so that they can be knowledgeable, not afraid of it, and not sort of intimidated by it. Because I think that's really empowering, regardless of what you choose to do. Just let it be somebody else's own choice, as opposed to the default option in terms of how you think about your own economic situation.
Yeah. And I think it's really nice, because so many people, I think, have such trauma associated with their past when it comes to finance, and they don't like to think about money too much, but it's something that can free you. It's something that can free you from that way that you grew up thinking, or maybe saw your parents struggling, you know, and just had this idea about money that is unfavorable or something that you don't want to explore. But just finding out that there's an option that is better for you. It's like health for your wealth. We had such a great conversation, and I thank you so much for joining me today. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep teaching those students. Keep spreading the word and inspiring other teachers to do the same with their classes and making it more of a general education course. It really should be. And keep doing what you're doing with SALT. You know, I'm very excited about it. I can't wait to share this with people and to show them that Bitcoin is more than just hoarding it and hodling it. And it's being used to spend on real things globally, and also as an asset to, you know, to use for secured backed loan instead of unsecured lending. That is a huge distinction from the traditional finance markets. So thank you again for your time. I appreciate you. And thank you for everything you're doing for Bitcoin.
Stacy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Have a great day.